Welcome. We'll get going. Like you, I'm hugely disappointed that Alexander Hefner was ill. I was looking forward to his session immensely. Interfaith is an area that I get involved in, and for some reason I foolhardily said I can do something there if you want. Anyway, so this is his topic, Civil Discourse in an Uncivil Age, The Quest for an Interfaith Postpartisan America. An interfaith postpartisan America. The part I work in is an interfaith postpartisan world, and so we'll be looking at that broader context. When you talk about civil discourse in an uncivil age, you'll see that this. I threw a bunch of slides together when I found out I was doing this. So they'll say Rotary on the corner down there. And the reason for that is because I'm also the global chair of the Rotarian Action Group for Peace. And that's a group that is trying to plan peace-building projects for Rotary clubs around the world. They're in virtually every country. And so the basis of this PowerPoint is part of a presentation that I did in Atlanta a couple of weeks ago at the Rotary Convention. But when you talk about civil discourse, peace, harmony, to me, it's all the same kind of thing, working together, getting along together. And I think that polarization is one of the great threats in this country and in the world today. It's an issue that in the Interfaith Roundtable and in the North American Interfaith Network, we're focusing on. And it's a marvel to me when you stop to think about it, how that even exists, because what does this number represent, would you guess? It's the percentage that we're all alike genetically. Every person in this room is 99.9% genetically identical to every other. We have the same hopes, fears, needs. We cry, we laugh, we suffer, we mourn, and we even all bleed the same. And when there's so much that we have in common, it's amazing to me how we swing so far to the other side and become so polarized. And that's partly because we have difference. And I think everyone in this room probably appreciates what an incredible blessing difference is. If every one of us was a clone of every other, life would be boring and not very educational. We learn from each other. We learn from each other's experience and background. When you have some kind of big decision, whether it's corporate or government or wherever, you benefit from getting lots of different perspectives on the issue and then working through together. This is just a little aside, but when Joseph Smith set up the Council of 50, is there somebody here that's familiar with the Council of 50 Minutes? There's a word I can't remember that I'm trying to think of. Joseph wanted every person to speak their mind. And he said he didn't want any yes people. He wanted people to say what they thought, not what they thought he wanted them to say. And he used a word, something like mutton heads or something similar to that. It's not that word. But Joseph really appreciated the value of experience and difference and contributing to the discussion together. I was interested to read an account of a contest that happened at a county fair in England some years ago, and they had this big ox, and the contest was to guess how much the ox weighed. And so they recorded everybody's guesses and had a raffle to figure out who was going to be a contest. And the thing that I thought was fascinating about it was there were people that guessed way high, and there were people that guessed way low, and some kind of closer, but nobody that was really right on. But they added up all of those guesses and divided by the number of people that guessed, and the weight, the calculated weight was, I think, within a pound of what the ox actually weighed. It was just kind of an indication about how what a benefit it is to have difference in experience and viewpoint. The problem, though, comes when we start focusing so much on difference that we're forgetting all of this stuff that we have in common. And when we do that, it leads to the kind of polarization that we're experiencing in the country. And when you start to get that kind of polarization growing, and I understand that it's happening in a lot of other parts of the world too, and you see that, but as that polarization goes, if you stop and ask yourself, what are the options? When you have polarization growing, what are the options? One is to continue the stagnation. Polarization just kind of freezes things. It's hard to move things forward and move along. So one option is you freeze things. The second option is if one party has more power than the other, they muscle their way through to kind of break the deadlock. What's the value of that? I mean, you can see that when there's coercion, that you that you end up with a really negative result, because there's always that resentment, there's uncomfortable feeling, there's this tendency to want to push back, and sooner or later there is that kind of pushback, and so it's not, the coercive way is not a positive sort of way. When you look at things that are happening politically in this country, I think you see some of that, the results of some of that, that one side will have enough power to force their side through, and so then the other side is going to come back at them. And so the third option is what? To take a deep breath, retreat a little bit, go back to what's shared in common, get your focus back, and then kind of work through it. Joseph said that the big problem is that people they're not usually willing to disagree long enough to be able to sort through the dross and get to the gold. And so that's one of the big challenges in the world. My conclusion as I looked at that was that difference should enrich what we have in common instead of eclipsing it. We somehow have to keep what we share in common right to the front. For years I've been concerned about there's such a focus on diversity. I think diversity is wonderful, but if you forget what's shared in common, you've taken a step back and impoverished society, I think. This is a book I came across a number of years ago. Uri Sevier was the lead negotiator for Israel in the Oslo Accord. And this is a book he wrote after 35 years of trying to negotiate and implement peace treaties. It's his frustrations. It's what's all wrong with the system. He says that the way we go about building peace is archaic. He laments. He points out that societies and governments act according to the dominant values and myths of the day, and that because of that, peacemaking must address the society's beliefs and ideals at its roots. So when you start trying to talk about the civility that we were talking about in the title, if you talk about peace, if you talk about harmony, that's what you're trying to do, is you're looking at society's beliefs and ideals at their roots and then trying to shift them somehow and improve them. He concludes that peace cannot simply be the domino effect of other processes, that peace has to come first. So you have to attack those dominant beliefs and myths. Now that's not to say everything just freezes until you get all that fixed, but it's to say that you focus on the things that will bring you to peace while you're working around all of those other kinds of things. He also concluded that as you try to come to that kind of peace first, that common values are the key. You got to somehow get people to focus on the things that are shared in common. President Kimball said in 1978, the great religious leaders and moral philosophers of the world each received a portion of divine light. Moral truths were given to them by God to enlighten whole nations. That rings true to me. It also seems to me that if that's true, and they're all getting light from the same source, that some of the light is the same light. And I think that's the case when you start looking at ethical teaching in the various faiths. The ethical teachings are similar, if not the same. And I believe, to the depths of my soul, that shared light is the greatest hope for humanity. And if we could get people to see the light that's shared in common, that gives that common value as the base to build the kind of world that we'd like to see. Now, on this, let me take a little sidestep. One of the things we're doing in the action group, the Rotarian Action Group, is on these peace projects, we're taking this approach. We're trying to attack the myths and beliefs of society and temper them with shared truth, with shared light. And to do that, we're putting together a little primer of basic peace-building principles. And I tell you that only so that this next slide will make sense to you. The purpose of the primer was to provide basic principles, to stimulate people's thinking, to give them suggestions for action, and to give them training resources. A word about conflict and how we arrived at the shared principles that are listed in the primer. Conflict isn't necessarily bad. If you think about it, there's a lot of growth that comes through conflict. Most of our development as humans comes from having problems and solving them. And so it's not the conflict itself that's bad, it's how you choose to try to resolve the conflict. And when you resolve it in positive ways, you experience growth, the other side experiences growth, and it can be a very positive thing. So with that backdrop, we took a look at root causes of violence. And in my estimation, I was in a three-month conflict resolution peace-building program in Bangkok that was fascinating. But when we started talking about roots of violence, all of the instructors would say that the causes are unique and complex to every conflict. I would think, surely there must be some similarities between them. And one of the things that I did, I mean, what they were doing was looking at the causes of the conflict rather than just the cause of violence entering the conflict. So I decided I didn't care what the cause of the conflict was. I wanted to look at what causes violence to enter a conflict. And to me, there were three root causes. First of all, that violence is a choice. There's some individual or group of individuals that makes a choice to inflict violence on another. And to me, there are three root causes. The first one is motivations, usually associated with power, resource, fighting over that sort of thing, greed, somebody wants somebody else's oil, those sorts of things. And there are others we listed. The second root cause, I think, is rationalizations. That's the things that we do to make it so that we can live with ourselves when we inflict violence on somebody else. So we make them seem like the bad guy. We devalue them, we dehumanize them, we vilify them, we make them evil, and so we're justified. When you think of the Rwandan conflict, that's one that particularly, I just end up shaking my head, and it's hard to understand, but the aggressors in that genocide referred to their victims as cockroaches. Cockroaches, a human being referred to as a cockroach. I mean, it wounds me to the core to even think about that. But that's how they justified killing them in mass. And so one of the things that is a root cause are those rationalizations. The third thing is culturalization and education. There's research that shows that humans are born hardwired for empathy, for compassion, for social interaction, and for fairness, a basic sense of fairness. And yet, you've heard the saying that nobody's born a bigot, nobody's born hating. Culturalization and education comes into play. And whatever that, this goes back to Yuri Severe's thing about the cultural myths and beliefs. So it's what people get inculcated with. One of the mantras that you hear in peace building all the time is that there's no peace without justice. And whenever I hear that, I say, and just who is it in the Middle East that's fighting for justice? Because I think everybody thinks they are. They just have a different view of a different narrative, a different view of what justice requires. And so that mantra, there's no peace without justice, if you don't refine it a bit, it actually can embolden people to be entrenched in their view because, after all, they're right. Justice requires this, when a lot of times justice doesn't require that. And in my view, the most fundamental principle is brotherhood, sisterhood. I think you can't even get to justice if you don't regard others as your brothers and sisters. And once you regard them as your brothers and sisters, you're on your way to justice. And when you regard them that way, I suppose there probably is no peace without justice. These are just a couple of examples of principles that we kind of focused on four main principles on this primer. And I think you'll see how these, it covers this other topic too. It's interfaith harmony. It's how we get along together. But the first one is individual responsibility, feeling each person having a sense of what they can do to make the world a better place. One of the things that I challenge the Rotarians is take a look at life through the peace builder lens. Picture yourself as a peace builder. Well, if you were a peace builder, what would you do different in your family, in your church, in your neighborhood, in your community? You usually know things you could do to build peace and to build better, stronger communities. And a lot of times we get distracted by other kinds of things. So part of it is that sense of individual responsibility. And one morning while I was attending a peace conference in Honolulu, I was sitting on a deck overlooking Diamond Head early one morning. It was a beautiful morning. And these words popped into my head. You may not be responsible for world peace, but you are responsible for yours, both your own inner peace and your piece of world peace. And so one of the things we're trying to do is get people to feel that they have a responsibility to the community and to the world and to their families for sure. Three other quick principles, integrity. You might like number three if you came for this conference for that reason, but some of you may be acquainted with the work of Brian Grimm, and I think he's speaking here. He, in working for the Pew Foundation, became aware that when respect for freedom of belief was low in a society, violence tended to be high. So one of the markers for building peace is just having respect for freedom of belief, allowing other people some space. And there's a group called the Institute for Economics and Peace that tries to put markers. And they say that the top indicator of peace in a society is intergroup cohesion. Do you find that surprising? That if people like each other, you have peace? To me, it's a definition that is just so. Anyway, so one of the challenges is what I call resonance. And that is that different people resonate with different things. So there are people that in the peace-building field, there are people that are atheists that the thing that resonates with them is peace science. And they have all of this proof to show you these things. If you do these things, you'll have peace. And that resonates with them, and it powers them. It fills them with passion. You have other people who are just darn good humanists. They don't believe in God, but they believe in humankind. And they work themselves to death trying to make the world a better place for other humans. And of course, faith-based people. And when you think about all of the different religions, there are a lot of people that resonate with different things. And one of the things that's been interesting to me in engaging in that arena is that when you come to those meetings, everybody thinks they have the answer. The peace scientists think they have the answer. The humanists think they have the answer. Everybody thinks they have the answer, so they don't stop to listen to each other enough, in my estimation. One quick example of that is I have a daughter that has a master's in conflict resolution studies. And she worked on this degree in Bradford, England. But they have a core text for this major called Contemporary Conflict Resolution, and it's an excellent text. It's got a lot of really great material in it. But I have a little bit of trouble with the final paragraph of it. And after wading through all of these principles of building peace, the last paragraph points out that each one of us has an identity, and that our identity is made up of a lot of sub-identities. So we have family, and we have ethnic group, and we have religion and we have nationality, and you know, you might have a professional association that makes up your part of your identity. And their conclusion, these three eminent scholars, was that you'll never have peace unless people consider all of those identities subordinate to humanity. So they say that your number one identity has to be humanity, and all of those other things are subordinate. How does that sit with you? I thought, well, that's a nice thought, but really? Do you think that's going to happen in our lifetime, that people are going to subordinate their family, their religion, their the things that they hold dear in favor of humanity? And it ties back to this concept of resonance, because in my mind, it's not even necessary for people to subordinate that. If you think about it, if you have a person that believes in God, that believes God is kind and beneficent, that believes that they are a child of God, and that every other person on this globe is a child of God, and that God expects them to tend to these other people, to love them, to uplift them in whatever way they can, tell me how it's a benefit to subordinate that to humanity. I mean, to me, it's a huge step backwards. And so it's just this kind of idea that different people resonate with different things, and you have this idea that I'm right and everybody's got to do it my way. And so what our suggestion is that when you define those basic principles of peace, let people get there by whatever path works for them. If they're a humanist and their blood turn, they get their passion stirred by those principles, great. Bring them in and tie into those principles. And if they're peace scientists, whatever field they come from. But let's look at the core principles, and let's allow people to join into those principles by whatever path works for them. In, I think, 2006, Madeleine Albright came out with this book. And it was heavily influenced by some work done by Doug Johnston and others that was published in 1996 called Religion, the Missing Dimension of Diplomacy. And one of the things that the secretary concludes in this volume is she mentions that over the years in diplomacy training, we've always taught diplomats to avoid talking about religion because it can become divisive. And her conclusion is that was a big mistake. We've been blindsided a number of times because by not understanding the religion, by not giving it credence, we didn't really understand the people. And so the flavor of what she's saying is that any diplomat with their salt, worth their salt, will understand the faith of the people in the area where they serve so they can understand the people and so they can communicate. She concludes that the challenge is to harness the unifying of potential of faith while containing its capacity to divide. When you look at the unifying potential of faith, I mean, the standards of how to treat each other are part of that, but to me, shared light is the greatest power for unifying. I think it's also the greatest power for containing the capacity to divide. I was involved with a discussion group that was working on some peace dialogue in Syria. And we had kind of monthly television or teleconferences with people in Syria, high-level religious people. And part of their concern was that they felt like the message coming out of Syria in the American press was not fair and balanced. They were hoping to give us another view. They were hoping to affect how the U.S. would view Syria and what the U.S. would do to engage there. And one of the issues that I raised with them was, even if the U.S. did kind of enter there, I mean, whose side do you think they should come on? I mean, who has the moral high ground in Syria? I'm pretty naive, but it's hard for me to figure out who's got the moral high ground there. And so one of the things that I've always felt is that if you could get this shared light going between all of those kinds of people, you can establish that moral high ground. And when you think about some of the subversive groups, the extremists, I think you've got to combat the sales pitch that got them there in the first place. And to me, there's no more powerful way to combat that than shared light. Shared light, to me, sets a threshold, kind of a baseline to start working from. And then I should hasten to add there that when I talk about shared light, I'm not talking about, you may have heard of syncretism. Syncretism is people trying to pull all religions together and make a new religion out of it, take the best of everything and come up with something new. And it's just establishing a baseline. And it doesn't detract from the grand teachings of the church or of any other group. So it's just looking at what we share in common and then you do things the way you think is right, we'll do things the way we think is right. And we can even try to convince each other that about what's a good way to do things. When I look at the greatest obstacles to peace, I think the first one is the twin evils of ignorance and arrogance. It's ignorance of the other, it's arrogant of your own position. Another one is not listening to each other. It's that resonance kind of thing where everybody thinks they've got the answer instead of stopping to listen. I've alluded to this already, but I think the greatest hope are those three things. And if we had time, I'd go into more action on them. I think the greatest challenges, first is just lack of vision and focus, being aware of what you can do, how you can contribute, not recognizing that, not seeing that vision, and then thinking small. I mean, one of the things we're trying to do is get people to think way big. And how do you get this shared light and permeate the world with shared light using social media, every form of action that you can? And so the inclination is to think big. If you think back to the topic here about how do we get that interfaith, post-partisanship America, a post-partisanship world, it's each of us thinking big and contributing, getting the ideas and expanding. Questions, comments, things you'd like to discuss? In the back up there? While she's going up, let me just tell you a little more specifically. We've kind of focused on 10 principles that we think are shared light. This is something that was adopted by the board of the Salt Lake Interfaith Roundtable. The first one is just individual accountability, that sooner or later you're responsible for the decisions that you make. Secondly is that we should each be true to the best that's in us. Every one of us has the power to make the world a better place or a worse place for people around us. We should exercise that power in positive ways. We should grow. I mean, as you look at this, you'll see these are all themes central to the gospel. Agency, accountability, growth, progression. The third principle is overcoming selfishness and greed, looking for things, living for something higher than self. The fourth one is something to do with how you regard humanity. And in faith traditions, there's teachings that we're all interconnected, that we're all have a portion of divine light within us, that we are children of God, that we're brothers and sisters in the family of God, and that we need to learn to view people in accord with that shared light. The next one is how you treat people, and central to that is the Golden Rule, which shows up in every religion and every culture, and teachings about love and kindness and forgiveness and those sorts of things. Another principle that's on that list is the importance of families teaching children their responsibility. When you think about the culturalization piece that was there, there's a responsibility for families to help culturize children for peace. There's a principle about every faith has some kind of sense that there's this something that you're striving to, this this connection to the infinite, this harmony with the divine, harmony with the source of wisdom and light, whatever you consider that source to be. And that even though there are different names for that source, it's usually something that's most praiseworthy and enduring, and something that's worth emulating, and that we should follow after. And that when we come into harmony with it, we have a love of all creation and a sense of that sort of thing. There's a provision that talks about that we should always be moving closer to the light. That when you get pulled into hatred and violence, you're moving away, you're distancing yourself. And so don't do that, and don't let anybody pull you into it, and don't you be pulling anybody else into hatred. There's one that's freedom of religion, that we just have to have the freedom to be able to live according to how we feel and believe. And there's one that has to do with reverence for the earth and the great resource that it is. Your question. Or comment.
Oh, it wasn't so much a question, it's just...
comments are welcome.
Along with what you were saying, the Pope just gave a TED Talk, and it was really good, and it has a lot to do with some of these principles that you're talking about. So I just was going to refer it to
the Pope's TED Talk.
The Pope's TED Talk.
I have a friend, Bob Groh, that was part of that same first class. He's credited as being the father of Envision Utah. So he looks at how you build strong communities. And he has a theory that I call percolation theory, and that is that whenever something great is about to happen, that God is preparing people in different places and different circumstances, and then it kind of builds, and at some point it all comes together. And if you're sensitive and aware, there's a real energy for interfaith relations in the world, and it is growing. And Pope Francis was a great one to mention. He, clear back when he was first made Pope, he issued a document called the Apostolic Exhortation. And he's got a number of places in there where he talks about the importance of interfaith relations. And one that I thought was particularly insightful is he said that it's not about tolerance. It's about reaping what God has sown in that person's heart, which then becomes a gift to you. And one of the great blessings of my life has been to associate with great people from all different faiths and to have that experience. They look at it differently. And when I went to a synagogue once and they were talking about forgiveness, and I was sitting there thinking, I believe this. And then I started thinking, if they're sincere in what they're saying, they're doing it better than I am. And I got some new perspectives on forgiveness from being around them. I have a Jewish friend that's training to be a rabbi. He says Torah means target. There's a word for sin in Hebrew that's C-H-E-I-T or C-H-E-T. That's their word for sin. But what it means is off target. That's an interesting way to look at commandments and sin, whether you're on target or off target. And so I think there's great, great things that can happen from that. Other comments, questions? Oh, you're close, and then over here.
I've had some wonderful experiences with working with interfaith communities across different religions and seeing some great things happen, because there's an honoring of what different faiths do have in common. The golden rule, a desire to make a difference, to care for our brothers and sisters, and recognizing that all of us are brothers and sisters. My concern lately is my own faith, and I am LDS, within some communities within the LDS tradition, I almost feel like I don't recognize how people are living the faith that I cherish so much, where I might attend meetings and Christ is never mentioned. The only things that might be mentioned are what I view as very political, you know, a very narrow definition of marriage or a narrow definition of family. And any attempts to bring it back to what I feel is common in my own faith, and that is Jesus Christ and the gospel of love, are met with resistance. So some of the concerns I've had lately is how I almost feel like I need to employ the very actions of interfaith conversations within my own sacred community, of trying to bridge a gap between a perception that is so differing, even within the same ward. And moving from one ward to another, it will be very Christ-centered, very lovingly inclusive, and you go to the next one, and it's very narrowly defined, very exclusive. And I'm trying to consider, you know, my entire lifetime of being in different aspects, and there just seems to be spots where there's great polarization. Is there a more intense way that we can, within even our own community, try to bridge these almost interfaith ways of looking at the religion that we share?
I could invite comments from others. My first thought as you were talking was recalling Elder Maxwell's statement that we're each other's clinical material. And when you get in those kinds of situations, there's learning that needs to happen, and there's expansion. I think some of it has to do with your grand view. One of the things that's interesting to me is if you are active LDS, I imagine you would have a sense that you have a duty to do something to prepare for the second coming, to prepare the earth for the second coming. In the second coming, Christ will reign over the whole earth. Not everyone will be Mormons, but there'll be some kind of feeling of harmony there. And to me, interfaith work prepares for that that glorious day when there will be people of all faiths living there and living in a condition of harmony. The suggestion of your question, I mean, the answer is yes. We ought to be looking at ways to always help each other expand views. And sometimes it's sensitive, sometimes it's delicate, sometimes hurtful, but I think, and sometimes we soften our own views as we have those discussions as well. Other comments, or I think you were next in line.
When you listed the 10 principles, I missed number 2. I have 2 other questions, so just get out.
2 was be true to the best that's in you. What?
Integrity.
Actually, that you're inspired. It says that right on the line. It says, have integrity, be true to the best that's in you. Good for you. And that's a huge deficit if you don't have it. That's a lot of societies struggle because it's not there, and corruption rules.
Okay, and 2 other things. I moved from Southern California, where I was involved in interfaith work, to Utah County, which was a cultural shock. And I have been looking for interfaith activities in Utah County. I don't know if you're familiar.
There's a Utah Valley Ministerial Association. I can put you in touch with them if you contact me.
Okay, and I'll give you my contact information. I'm also interested in what projects are you doing with your interfaith group to promote peace and this understanding? You know, what exact kind of projects have you been putting into place?
Because the Interfaith Roundtable evolved out of the Olympic Organizing Committee, every year on the anniversary of the Olympics being here, we host Interfaith Month. And during Interfaith Month, we have open houses at the synagogues and mosques and temples of the various faiths. We encourage people to come and get to know their neighbors at the synagogue. They teach them how to make challah bread, and so they get familiar with what they do. The big mosque in Salt Lake, the Khadija Mosque, the imam there is from South Africa, and he's very, very funny. And he usually give a little speech and make people laugh and make them feel warm. So we do that. And then the culminating event, and I have some pictures if you want to see them, but we have an interfaith music night. And we used to move that from faith to faith, but it got too big, so we have it in the tabernacle. And the church makes it available without charge, and they give us the camera crew and the light crew and all that stuff, so it's a great benefit. And we have music and dance from all the different faiths, some prayers and spiritual thought, but it mostly focuses on that culture. And it usually will be mid-March, because of the Super Bowl. Otherwise, it would be in February. Let me just tell you a couple of quick stories about that. We had, some years ago, we had children's choirs from all these different faiths. And I visit services at all these different places. And whenever I go to the Buddhist service, they end with a recitation. And it says basically, I am a link in Buddha's golden chain of love that stretches around the world. Let me be a strong and bright link. Let me be kind to every living thing. And then there's some sentiments about being especially mindful of the unfortunate. And then it says, let me think pure and beautiful thoughts, speak pure and beautiful words, and do pure and beautiful deeds. And may every link in Buddha's chain be strong and bright. And then there's some amen clauses to that. And so I asked this Buddhist children's choir if they would do that recitation at the end of their song. And we put the words up on the big screens on the sides of the tabernacle, of the organ. And the woman that was sitting next to me leaned over and she said, I had no idea Muslim or Buddhists believe that. That's a beautiful thing to believe. And that's the kind of thing we try to do, is expose people to some of the beautiful teachings of others. And when you see some of the beautiful teachings, your respect for them just grows. Another comment?
Interfaith deals with, fostering understanding between peoples of different beliefs. I'm curious if you've had any experience or how that interfaith work interacts with fostering cooperation between faith-based and non-faith-based groups. So groups that are irreligious, the unaffiliated from the last session, and faith-based groups. So that seems like a big divide. Just as there are big divides between religious groups, fostering cooperation across religious versus non-religious grounds seems like another big divide. Do you have experience in that?
Some. It's a great point, and I'm glad you brought it up. When we came up with these 10 principles, we ran it past some atheists and some people who are not believers, and they would go, yeah, I agree with that, I agree with that, I agree with that. So we tried to couch it. Even when you read the Shared Truth document, it talks about truths that are shared by people from many of the great faiths and of no faith. On the Interfaith Roundtable, when we do that thing at the Tabernacle, it's called Many Faiths and Beliefs, One Family is the title that we go under for that. Rotary has people of all different faiths, but Rotary, you don't talk about religion at Rotary. It's kind of a non-topic, the elephant in the room. And to me, one of the great deficits in the world is that we can't respectfully discuss religion with each other, and that groups like Rotary push it out. And so one of the things we're trying to do is get them to see ways that you can have respectful discussions. We have, in the North American Interfaith Network, we have young adult scholarships, where every year for our annual meeting, we grant some scholarships to young adults. And we've had, the last couple of years, they give a couple of those to atheists there, and they try to bring them into the discussion. And that's an interesting dynamic too, because once they're there, they sometimes want to be more there. And then they're wondering if you really should be talking about religion so much. And you say, wait a minute, this is an interfaith organization. That's what we do, we talk about religion. Yeah, that's a great point, and it's something that needs to be front and center and that we need to be concerned about, making sure that even people that don't have religious beliefs feel welcome to be involved in the discussion. Other thoughts?
You were saying that there are all these events that go on, I think, in March. How do you find out more about all those? Because they sound great.
The website for the Interfaith Roundtable is interfaithroundtable.org, and there's a calendar there. They take the summer off, but they have weekly or monthly meetings during the rest of the year. There are a couple of other activities that you can tie into there. Other questions? Yes?
So how do we get involved in the Salt Lake Interfaith?
Salt Lake Interfaith? Talk to me after. Does anybody else want to know the answer to that question? How do you get involved in interfaith in Salt Lake? When I was in law school, when they talked about how they were going to teach ethics, they decided what they were going to do was have what they called the planned pervasive method. So rather than having specific ethics courses other than those required by accrediting institutions, they were just going to have it permeate anything, everything. And I think that's the best approach to interfaith. I think to start it in your own neighborhood, to look for people. One of the things we encourage Rotary clubs around the world to do is take a look at their demographics and then look at the demographics of the community and find out who's not at the table and invite them to come and join Rotary so that you can build that kind of intergroup cohesion. But I love to see it just developing in neighborhoods. There's neighborhoods where they'll have a Messiah and sing in, and they'll have people of all Christian faiths get together. And I don't know if you saw in the newspaper recently, there was an LDS ward that was fasting with their Muslim neighbors on Ramadan and then breaking the fast together after sundown. So I think when you look at it on the personal basis first and then just see what you can do to spread it is the best thing. Let me tell you what this slide is about. I think these are three of the most important questions of our time. And you might say, what box? And in ethics for lawyers, there's two boxes. Historically, it's kind of blended together, but historically, the lower box is filled with disciplinary rules. That's the things that if you violate, like if you steal your client's money, you're going to get disbarred. And the upper box is what was called ethical considerations. Those were the higher standards that all lawyers should aspire to. They're standards of decorum and decency and respect. And you can see that if you didn't have those higher standards, that the law would be impoverished. That if you had, I mean, there's enough shouting going on now, but if there were not those ethical considerations, you would the law could become brutish. And so there's those same two boxes exist in civil society. The lower box with the similar civil and criminal law, and the upper box typically is filled by what? By the ethical standards that come from where? They're taught in the homes and the churches and wherever else in the community ethical standards come from. And so the big question is, who fills that upper box? And as there's been pressure to push religion out of the public square, then you just say, well, okay, who's going to fill the box? And I think it's a good question to think about, how we contribute to the public discussion and add to the richness of society and not be pushed out. When you think about that, I mean, I had a book in law school called The Enforcement of Morals by Sir Patrick Devlin. It was a series of discussions by an English barrister, but one of the things he was arguing is that you have to be careful about trying to enforce moral standards because it can come back to bite you. And so he was suggesting that the moral standards, I mean, some of them have to be in the lower box, like not taking somebody else's life and those kinds of things. But when you get beyond that, he was suggesting that maybe some things should be in the upper box, but we should keep that upper box filled. And you see that some people try to fill the box. The questions were, who fills it, how, and with what? And the how, some people try to fill it by coercion. Think of ISIS. You can think of a lot of historical examples where somebody came and they were going to impose their will on somebody else. And if you think about that marker, that respect for freedom of belief is one of the markers for peace in a society, filling it by coercion doesn't work. There's a lot of other kind of strong-arm tactics that people use to try to fill the box. Hollywood tries to fill the box. I was at a discussion at UVU involving the religion writer for one of America's most prominent newspapers, and she started out by saying that if a story doesn't stir up controversy, it's not newsworthy. And a half hour later, she ended by talking about the nuns and about the young and rising generation and how they tend not to want to associate with religion. And so in the question and answer period, I just pointed that out to her, that she started with, it's not news unless it stirs up controversy, and then that young people don't want to be associated with religion. I said, do you see any connection between the two? I mean, if you're trashing religion in the press all the time, can you see that young people might not want to be a part of it? And she said, touche, you got me there. And so that's a filling of the box. And so people just need to be vibrant in the public square and respectful of each other. One of the points that came out as we wrap up here in the earlier session is that one of the problems, I think, on the horizon for religious freedom is that some of the left-leaning groups, and especially the LGBT community, see the right people on the right using religious freedom as a way to attack the advances that the LGBT community has been able to gain. And if people on the right use religious freedom that way, I think they really endanger their cause. I think it's something that comes back to bite them. When you look at the Utah Compact and how faith leaders and LGBT leaders got together and did something that was respectful and cooperative of both sides is the better approach. And so I think using force to fill the box is not the right way to do it. Comment?
Going back to your comment about interfaith groups and neighborhoods, as we discussed today, as our own experience, many people don't relate to faith-based groups. You like them, right?
You'd like those people to be a part of your group. So I'm just thinking about the words interfaith. If people don't associate with a religion, how do you also invite them to come and share the things that guide their life and the things they have to offer? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I understand what you're saying. Do you have the answer?
I don't.
that's why on the round table, when we have that function at the Tabernacle, we call it Many Faiths and Beliefs. One year we said many faiths and none, one family. And so we try to do that sort of thing. I mean, it's an interesting challenge because if you try to accommodate them too much, you can just dilute the very thing you're trying to do. I think it's good to keep interfaith there. One of the side points, there's an Orthodox community of Jews in Salt Lake. And the rabbi there always thought that interfaith meant interfaith marriage, which he was strongly against because it would interfere with propagation of the Jewish population. And when he finally understood that, no, we're not talking about that. We're not talking about you trying to change each other. We're trying to understand each other and to care for each other. He ended up hosting us for lunch at the synagogue. So it was a great thing. So there's a lot of misunderstanding, and we just always need to try to be working on education and addressing that. But being mindful of all and sensitive to all. I think we're done. Are we done? I got the done sign. Thank you.